Cauldron with us today, we have Professor Hannah Darlan. Hannah is a Professor of Midwifery, Discipline Leader of Midwifery and Associate Dean in the School for Nursing and Midwifery at Western Sydney University. She has been a midwife for 30 years and still practices. Hannah has had over 200 papers and book chapters published. She has spoken at over 100 national and international conferences in the past 5 years and given invited keynote addresses at most of these. In 2019, Hannah was awarded a Member of the Order of Australia, General Division, in the Queen's Birthday Honours List for her significant services to midwifery, nursing and medical education and research. In November 2012, Hannah was named in the Sydney Morning Herald's list of 100 people who change our city for the better, and named as one of the leading science and knowledge thinkers for 2012. In this episode, Hannah talks us through her incredible beginnings growing up as the daughter of a midwife and her early initiation into the birth world in Yemen, how her passion for feminism and supporting women was seeded into her through her young girl experiences, seeing and recognizing how differently women and girls are treated and seen. Hannah shares with us her own connection to the real life called the Midwife book through her mother's experience of working in the East End of London. And she kindly shares with us her incredible and heartfelt story from midwife to professor and what keeps her fire burning to continually strive to improve the outcomes for women and infants globally. Hannah's interview with us is one of story and delight, utter strength and empowerment despite the odds. A must listen for everyone, as this will definitely leave you feeling positive for the future and grateful for women like Hannah who work in this field. So enjoy this episode. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now and hear us on your favourite podcast host. I would like to say thank you, Hannah, so much for joining us on the Midwife's Cauldron. It is an absolute joy and pleasure to have you here with us today. And can't wait to just extract some golden nuggets from your brain for our listeners.
Let's hope it's working at 6 p.m. in the evening.
I hope so too.
I'm sure it is.
Hannah, many people will know exactly who you are and will have read your work. It is prolific, and you have been working in this world of midwifery and birthing and the whole continuum with women for so many years. But we have listeners who don't hail from Australia, even though your work is global and worldwide. But we also have a lot of women who are pregnant, new mums who listen into the cauldron. And I would just love for you to give us a little bit of an introduction of who you are and how you came to this place where you're at now, which is really, really impressive and wonderful for us to hear.
And a huge sphere of influence.
Huge.
I'm not sure about all of that. But anyway, thank you very much. And I have listened to one of your podcasts and I was very impressed. So it's really great work you're doing. And of course, I know Rachel so well and love her dearly and love her work and her revolutionary spirit. And we sure need a lot of revolution at the moment. I think we're in desperate need of major revolution. So my background is I was born in Yemen. My mum and dad worked over there. My mum was a midwife. And I, from the earliest memories that I have, I was in the clinics watching my mum care for the women. My playthings were a spatula and a kidney dish. That's my very first memories of these beautiful decorated black painted hands. It was called Nakash, where they did this lovely, the Moroccan women do it as well, but embroidered painted hands would come over my playpen and pull at my hair. They were always very intrigued that I was that maybe I was a little wizened up old woman. They used to call me Sheba, which means old lady, because they couldn't believe anyone could quite have the colour hair. And then they would look at my blue eyes and then they would usually scream and cover their eyes because I have the evil eye colour. So that was my kind of introduction to life, that I was a little bit odd. But, you know, I watched my mum. I never thought they would do anything other than be a midwife. And then when I was 10, I begged to go into my first birth and was amazed at that experience, had a lot of questions, which I didn't quite know how to place because I had no reference point. And then when I was 12, coming just nearly 12, it was the 1st of July, and it was I turned 12 on the 6th of July, and my next door neighbour, her sister-in-law was having a baby, and I had been involved through the whole pregnancy in trying to get her iron injections because she had severe anemia, and carrying the children, walking for an hour across to find somebody to give her an iron injection, walking back. And so I got very invested in her. And I remember saying to her husband once, "You've got this really good Land Rover. Could you just drive us because it's hot work?" And he said to me, "She's not worth the petrol." And for me, it was, and I'm an 11-year-old girl on the brink of womanhood, and the rage and the fury and the complete injustice that one person's life is less valuable than another really kind of permeated me very, very young. And anyway, when she gave birth one night, I was over there and I came over and I helped the local midwife catch this beautiful little girl. And it was in the top room of this, you know, beautiful Yemeni house. And she had two other daughters. And I said, "You've got a little girl." And she said, "Take it away." And I remembered again the feeling of, I knew exactly why she said that to me, because this was her third girl. And if she didn't produce a son, her husband would divorce her or marry another woman, because there was no understanding of who determines the sex of the child. And I took this little baby over to the window, and the dawn was breaking in the Middle East. And I remember the minarets starting to call and being utterly transfixed with what I was holding in my arms, this perfect human being. And utterly furious that because this child was a girl, everything, her entire destiny had been written as lesser. And so for me, that kind of my beginning really, I guess, symbolizes why I am who I am, which is passionately committed to women's health, women's rights and childbirth, but also a passionate feminist. And I think we can't extract one from the other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wow, what a story. My goodness me. Thank you for sharing that with us. Gosh, it feels like I've just immersed myself into, you know, a storybook about a midwife who had those roots, and you've just shared that with us. You were in Yemen, and then when did you move to Australia, and when did you start your training, and how did you find that?
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
Yes. So, and I was correspondence school. So I'd never been to a proper school. I had literally taught myself because my mum had six children under the age of seven. Good Christians, you know, God supplies the children. I was the oldest and I had a lot of brothers. And I remember very early on giving up that I was going to ever get any kind of focus on my education. So I used to teach myself. And then when I was 15, we went back home because me and my parents were missionaries, and you get a furlough every 4 years and you get to go back home and, you know, drink real tea bags that aren't used tea bags that you get shipped when you're a missionary. It's a fascinating life. And you get to, you know, drink milk out of a bottle because everything was powdered in Yemen, and you know, literally there was two foods that you ate. So we went back when I was 15 and I did year 10. I entered into a school of 1,500, Pennon Hills High School, having been, you know, the only one in my class, doing all my own homeschooling. And then I would fill out the forms, send them back to Australia. 6 months later, you might get a result. So I had no comprehension of what it meant to be like, where are you in the class? What does it all mean? What's competition? And I came into the school of 1,500. And I'd gone from being, you know, being blonde and blue-eyed was like, you know, something to be a bit wary of, to entering Australia where being blonde and blue-eyed was actually something that was quite desirable. So it was a huge confrontation and cultural twist. And so I ended up finishing school, just to get to the short story, because there's lots of deviations in my life. And I couldn't do midwifery without doing nursing at that point. So I went to Hornsby Hospital. I did my certificate in nursing. I'm that old, because there was no university education when I did my nursing training. I was the last group that ever went through the hospital system. And then it changed to university. I was very anti-university, which you may find funny coming from a professor now, because I thought they were all very out of touch, you know, idealists who had no idea about the real world. And all I wanted to do was be a midwife and be with women and catch babies. And I wanted to do that in England because my mother was one of the real call the midwife midwives. So she worked in the real Nanada's house, which is St. Bride's Wine. And she worked there with Jennifer Wirth, who wrote the books. And in fact, her best friend we think is Chummy in the books, who I'm still very friendly with. So she's 6'6" and kind of India and was very clumsy, and she just fits everything about that whole story. So we're quite convinced she's Chummy.
Wow.
So I'd heard these stories of riding, you know, through the Docklands of England on cobbles, and her, my mum's very first birth as a student midwife was undiagnosed twins in a tiny Dockland flat. And she came home and she came home to the nurse's home, told everybody, and they were all like so jealous. And all I can think today is, if that happened, everyone would be the incident reports, because you hadn't diagnosed that second twin. Yeah. Imagine there'd be an inquiry. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in this magic and went to England as soon as I finished my nursing. I'd met the man I ended up marrying just inconveniently before this, and he'd asked me to marry him, and I said, well, if you really love me, you'll wait. I'm going to England to do my midwifery, and I headed off. And clearly it worked because he waited. And then I did my midwifery in Surrey, absolutely loved it, 18 months, again, hospital training, and some of the best years of my life. Travelled Europe, of course, in a combi, went back to Yemen and found my friends from my 15 years, did voluntary work in the Middle East, and came back to Australia, where I then entered, started working at a place called Auburn Hospital, and decided, actually, this university thing I probably have to do, get a degree, because it seemed like everyone was doing it at that point. And so I did the abridging to get a BN, a Bachelor of Nursing, and got invited back to do an honours. Very funny story there. I don't know if it's funny, but I had, because I'd never done in that system, when I first got my very first report, or not your report, but, you know, your marks at the end of semester, I remember being really upset and going to the teachers and the students and saying, I don't understand. Well, they just printed my initials down the column on the right-hand side. I don't know what my marks are. And my initials are HD. one of my friends saying, if you don't know what that is, you don't deserve it.
I'm just going to say, for the non-Australians, a HD means a high distinction. So it's the best you can get.
So I discovered, actually, I was quite good at this studying thing. And then I got invited to do an honours, but decided I wanted to do a master's, because a master's, of course, is so much more important. And I did a master's of maternal child health. And then I realised I couldn't get into a PhD, which now I was starting to think about. So I went back and did my honours. So I have a very convoluted career. And I often give this as an example to students when I'm talking to them about research. Got a first class honours and then went on to leave Auburn Hospital and go to RPA because it was King George V at that time, because I wanted to go to a big hospital and become a super midwife and learn all of those high-risk skills. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't realise was I was leaving a haven of normality, which was Auburn, where just normal birth happened all the time, where I used warm pads, where women birthed in all sorts of positions, where we used aromatherapy. And I went to RPA, and I was the educator in the delivery ward, and it was called that. And the very first day I walked down the corridor with a bowl of steaming water and a hot cloth, because I had learned how to do this in England and been mesmerized by its impact. And you would have thought I was sacrificing a goat in the middle of the corridor. And I was told, what was I doing? And that was completely ridiculous, and it would burn someone and to cease it. And so I set off to do the world's largest randomized controlled trial on warm compresses, because I was very convinced there was something to this. And so I did everything wrong. I designed the study. I went to Johnson & Johnson and said, will you give me $1,500 so I can translate the study? I literally ran the whole trial until the very wonderful Caroline Homer, who is an amazing professor of midwifery, said, Hannah, you're doing a PhD here. Why are you not getting a PhD? So I said, if you like the study and you're not going to change it, I'm happy to enter a PhD. And so halfway through randomising my 717 women, I had to stand up and do my confirmation of candidature, which Rachel knows well, and they accepted me. And so I finished the warm pack trial, got my PhD in about 2007. And at this point, I'd had many things happen in my life. I'd had a beautiful girl, Lydia, a powerful triumphant birth. I'd then gone on the following year when she was about four to have a little boy, full-term boy, very long, horrible labor, ended up a cesarean section transfer from a planned home birth, and after 2 days we had to switch his ventilator off. And so I lost Luke, a full-term 42-week beautiful boy. Nobody knew why. Autopsy showed nothing. Nobody knew. I knew there was something wrong. It didn't feel right. Went on, got pregnant immediately. And within the year to the date that we were burying Luke, I was giving birth to Ethan, and he came out and he didn't cry either. And then they realized they'd missed something major. And we went through 11 days of horrendous testing. In fact, they sent the blood samples to Vienna to try and find what was going on, to find out it was an incredibly rare genetically linked form of a dystrophy, which was about a 1 in 2 million, because I wasn't even a carrier at this point. And then at 11 days we switched Ethan's ventilator off. And you can imagine how that utterly punches you in the gut. And then we went through failed IVF, we went through if anyone was ever going to give you everything in the textbook, I think I pretty much had it. And then after we were just about to give up, I got pregnant on a blue moon. I got pregnant with Lydia on a full moon. I got pregnant on a blue moon, and I knew instantly this was that little baby I knew was out there, and that was our Bronte, who came into our lives and has been an utter and total joy. And so then I'm doing a PhD at the same time, running a large randomized trial and going
forward. Oh, my goodness.
And then I finished my PhD, and this wonderful professor who I worked with, Virginia Schmid, came to me and said, look, there's an associate professor job going at Western Sydney. Why don't you apply? And I went, the ink's not even dry on my testimony. You know, who's going to want me? But I went for the interview and I got the job. Wow. And that was it, really. Kind of then got promoted to professor, and I've not left. But at the same time, I went out into private practice in 2010. Because it was all happening, and I'd been part of the whole lobbying for the reforms and all of the battles in the Senate to get Medicare for midwives. So I thought, you know, I'll go out, and I became an eligible midwife, which Rachel knows all about. I got, you know, pharmacology under my belt and went into private practice for 10 years. And I've only just stopped doing that in the last year, just juggling everything ended up just being too much. I discovered I'm not a superwoman, which is very good thing to discover before you kill yourself. Yeah. And so that's, and I did many, many home births. And it was, for me, it was full circle, because my first births were home births. And I just thought that was just it was so intuitive to me. And then I went through these many years of hospital births to come back to those wonderful 10 years of home births.
Wow. I just can't believe that you did that alongside all of the research that you've done. Perhaps you are a superwoman, or as close as.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm very human, but I'm very driven, and I really deeply believe in what I do. And I think those things can carry you through pretty much everything in life.
Mm. So what are you doing now?
What am I doing now? So for my sins, I never thought I'd go into academia, never then thought I'd be a professor, and then I never thought I would have the word dean in my title. So I'm now an associate dean, of course, for research and high degree research. I manage all of the research and high degree research, as well as my professor of midwifery role, and I'm midwifery discipline lead at the uni. But what's so exciting in my research now is the birth and trauma COVID study, which has been obsessing me for the last 2 years, where we've done interviews with women and midwives. We've designed some really fantastic surveys. We've had a whole 5,000 cohort from 2020, and we're now gathering 2021 data, and we're following them up. So we've done 2 months, 6 months, 12 months. We're doing now follow-up surveys, planning a 2-year follow-up, and looking at what is the impact of what happens to women when they're pregnant during a pandemic, and the impact on them and their children, and what are the modifying factors. So how do models of care make a difference? How does it make a difference having a midwife? You know, how does it make a difference having a good mental health? How does it make a difference having a resilient spirit? What are the things that shape the way you and your baby will emerge from what we have been through in 2020. And I can tell you so far, in a nutshell, being resilient, having good support, having a positive attitude, those things are fundamentally important in our survival. So how do we make more of that? Yeah, it's a critical question, because I don't also want to be one of those people to say, let's always be positive, 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 positive. I'm not into that. I like calling things shit when they're shit.
Yeah.
But how do we have the spirit that drives us through and believes at the other end there is something to hope for?
Yeah. And I think that's the key word as well, is hope, which is a really important. If you don't have hope, what is there? Whether you're a student midwife going through your training, and or you're a mum in the middle of a pandemic, which so many thousands and millions of women have been through. And yeah, this is, it's absolutely about that. But you're quite right. It's not, it's almost like we can see this, we know this. And when we talk to Professor Amy Brown as well, she said something, it's like, you know, I research almost the stuff that we know, but then it's about getting the message out, and how do we then bring in this resilience? How do we bring in this ability for us to hold on to that hope, to know that there is the light at the end of the tunnel, or to, you know, because it's not possible for every woman to have support and care. I mean, you explained that, and the very first thing you said when you were 11, and you asked the father to be to drive his wife instead of her to walk, and he said she wasn't important enough. And we know that continues in so many family units anywhere in the world.
And to be in lockdown and in a domestically violent relationship would be just like, you know, it would be horrendous. So, you know, I don't want to paint it in a positive light either. I think this has been an incredibly hard 2 years for all of us. And for some of us, this has really broken spirits in a way that we can't even comprehend.
And it's great that you're capturing all of that. And that was one of the questions that I really wanted to kind of ask you is, like, what is the point of research? I get that asked all the I get asked that all the time. Like, so what? You know, why is it important that we do research and that midwives, woman-centered midwives, are involved in research?
Yeah. Well, I remember the very first research question I asked. I was 11 and I was helping out in the clinic in the deserts of Arabia, and I was given a job where I'm pretty sure they thought if they gave me this job, I wouldn't go into health, which was to clean the burns out. And women would come on donkeys days, you know, because they did a lot of cooking in big open fires, put their hands in, they got a lot of burns on the arms. And my job was to pull that out so that they could be creamed and bandaged and sent back into the mountains. And I remember pulling all this honey out. So they packed it with wild Yemeni honey, which is actually very famous and very expensive now. And even the bees were still in the honey. And I remember pulling it out. And looking, and I'd look at this beautiful, clean, red flesh. Wow. And I remember thinking, I wonder if the honey is doing something. And so I said to the doctor, I said, do you think the honey might be good? It might be doing something. And I'm 11, mind you. And he patted me on the head and he said, oh, there, that's a very funny thought. Now go put the SSD cream on and these lovely white bandages and we'll send her back into the mountains, never to have it changed again. He didn't say that, but that's what happened. And so when I look back years later, in 1998, they did the first randomized controlled trial of SSD cream and honey, and guess which healed better? Honey. This ancient knowledge that had been handed down through generations and generations that had observed the effect of honey, which was actually scientific work, just not published and systematic in the way we do it today, had been dismissed by a modern medicine approach, which is, first we're white, we're educated, so we are so much better than these people. And, you know, we're going to give you what's good for you and use our knowledge and skills. So that was my first research question. And what I keep saying to my students is research is just about really good questions. Mm-hmm. And then it's about being bloody persistent, because you then need to go through this very systematic approach to find the answer. So I see it as a curiosity. My mind is so curious about everything, so I'm never stopping the questions. But why should midwives do it? If midwives don't do it, and through all of history, midwives have not done it, though they have in their own organic way of handing knowledge on, look what happened, how medicine dominated, how women's knowledge got wiped out, how we ended up in a world where, you know, over one in three babies are born through cesarean section, how, you know, 45% of first-time mothers are being induced. We've ended up in a world like we are because we've not had enough midwifery view in saying, ask and do research, ask the question and do research, because nobody else is going to. And if we don't, we don't challenge a very mainstream, dominant, medical, dichotomous, Descartesian perspective of how our body is divided up into bits that need to be fixed. And midwifery is about the whole. And the exciting thing, when everyone gets really down, I say, just think about this. The first professors of midwifery are alive today. They're alive and kicking. Leslie Barclay, the first professor of midwifery in Australia, and she's well and truly with us. The first professors of many other disciplines, including medicine, are dead and buried many, many years ago. Gosh, look what's happened in 30 years. what midwives have contributed to, what amazing research they've led, how they've become names in the Cochrane reviews, in massive research, how they've influenced WHO standards, how they are at every table. And I look at that, and when people get depressed, they go, hold on a minute. Imagine in 100 years exactly what midwives will have contributed. So that's why it's so critical midwives ask the questions, because they're going to ask different questions. They're going to shape a different future. And it's hard because you do get belittled. You do get put down. I've been called all sorts of names. I'm sure there's big dartboards around the nation or the world with my face on it. But if you believe what you are saying, you are underpinning that with evidence, and you are doing it in a systematic and an honourable and respectful and trusted way, and then you put the message out in that same manner, you can't help in the end but win. And the other thing that we've got as midwives that I don't see obstetric having, and that's the hearts and minds of women. That has been the power of midwives. When midwives talk about their research, when they go out and they do things, whether it's to rally in front of parliament or whether it is to go visit a minister or whether it is to, you know, lobby in the media, they do that alongside women. And that is an enormously powerful thing.
Wow, that has really hit me with the whole professors in midwifery for 30 years. Gosh, that's really put it in perspective. And it's given me hope as well of definitely those days when you just think, I just feel like I'm walking in mud. When will we ever get this change? Everything just seems to be going, you know, south. Look at the induction rates, look at the cesarean rates. And I want to cry. It's just, I feel like I've got no power left. And you've got, you know, we have so many messages from student midwives. They're going through their courses and they're struggling to even think, what am I going to do when I get to the end of this 3 years? And gosh, that's like a beacon of hope when you think that is so powerful, such a powerful message. Thank you for sharing that.
We're so immediate in our time. Like, I love history. I just love history because history teaches us to be patient and reflective and to pace ourselves for the long haul. And if you think about the history of midwifery, it is phenomenally ancient. It is one of the most ancient professions. Mm-hmm. It's embedded throughout history. But if you think about the history of midwifery in an academic frame, coming into an established medically dominated frame, it is incredibly recent. But the most exciting thing is that all the research we do constantly proves midwifery is right, midwifery is best, relationships work, the body and the mind and the spirit are one, and we should treat them like that. And so we're just constantly proving ourselves. I mean, it's a delightful business to be in, that you do a study and you find out, oh, guess what? Midwives best. Midwives work best. Let's have more midwives. And then you hear the WHO kind of saying exactly the same thing. And so, you know, take heart. It's tough. It's tough. But we're on the right track.
And to some extent, the backlash to me proves that we are, because if there wasn't a threat, we wouldn't be encountering the kind of backlashes that we get.
Totally true. If you are irrelevant, nobody makes any response to you. So it's absolutely true. I think that, and it's interesting, I'm watching the backlash change. Like, I know when I've spent, you know, I was very involved in the College of Midwives, and I'd be in the media constantly in really aggressive opposition to obstetricians. Mm. I'm actually seeing that discourse quieten. Of course, it erupts every so often, but there is a definite shift going on where they're also getting the time's up. So let's get on board, and how can we be a part of this and make it work for all of us? So the discourse is changing.
And do you think it's helped with particularly your recent publication? And I want to look at this slightly in terms of the induction of labour and this big trial that you published this year. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that and also what the response has been from the obstetric world and from the world in general, because this is a significant piece of work.
Yeah, so a little background on that. It's always interesting to know the background. I mean, what motivated us to do that study was the ARRIVE trial. When I saw that published, I went, oh, wait on a minute. There is a massive problem here. A very well done study. It's a randomized trial. All of those things absolutely in place. And then as I started to look at how many women said they wouldn't be involved, when you're looking at over 80% of women saying, nah, sorry, we don't want to be involved, we actually don't want to be induced. When you actually started to look at it, you went, they're missing so many things in this study. This is not a generalizable population. So that's when we set off, and it's not me. I have a wonderful international team, multidisciplinary international team, and we set off. And it took us 3 years to do that study. And a lot of people think you just kind of, I don't know, generate research out of, I don't know, but it took 3 years because I knew it would be so controversial and we had to get everything in place. And we went back to the drawing board again and again and again on that paper because it had to be typed. It had to be rigorous. And when it got published, we had lined up the media, we had lined up the conversation articles, we had everything ready to go, and it hit. And look, midwives celebrated it, obstetricians didn't like it. And obstetricians had some valid arguments, which was it wasn't a randomized controlled trial. My argument back was, well, you give me 100% of your population that are involved in your study, and then I'll tell you you've got a generalizable randomized trial. I'm giving you another option. I'm giving you longer term. I'm giving you bigger population. And, you know, there's a lot of other things being looked at. But I guess the proof's in the pudding. It was the most downloaded article in the BMJ Open in the months of June and July, the top that they'd ever had. In fact, they wrote an article about it. So somebody was reading it. perhaps, you know, to use as toilet paper, but perhaps also because I think we've got to stop the, you know, midwives good, obstetricians are bad. I actually think there's a lot of really tortured, conflicted obstetricians who also don't agree that inducing women without any good reason is a good thing. So the response has been mixed. There's been valid criticism, which there should be because it's not a randomized controlled trial and there are always flaws with big population-based studies. And there has been also great interest. And I was really excited because it came out just as NICE released their discussion paper in the UK. And a lot of people forwarded it to NICE. And, of course, Sue Down was on it, and Sue Down's intimately involved a lot of stuff in the UK. So, yeah, and we would keep going. We have more to come because we're doing the best survey at the moment in Australia, the birth experience study. And my lovely colleague Hazel Keedle, who you should really interview because she's amazing and she's done beautiful work on VBAC, but she and I are leading this study on birth experiences. We've got nearly 10,000, we've got over 10,000 women who've responded, and we've got questions in there about induction. And we've asked women their decision-making, did they make the decision? And if they were to look back on it, would they in hindsight made the same decision now they know what it's like? And we have hundreds and hundreds of comments as well that we're analysing. So women don't like induction. They don't like it.
No.
They would prefer not to have an induction. Yeah.
It seems that way from everything you can read.
Yeah, and it's more painful. And it has, you know, it, women need more epidurals, and women have more drips in their arms and catheters in their bladders. And, you know, there are many other tiny little things that are not just about whether your baby comes out of your vagina or through your abdomen. Absolutely. There are many things about induction that changes birth.
And I know you're looking at long-term outcomes as well, not just those short-term outcomes that usually get all of their focus.
So that's another interest we've got, which is looking at epigenetics and the microbiome.
Yeah.
And that really, you know, that came out of the EPIC hypothesis that we developed in 2013 and have done a lot of work tracing the ripples is what I call it. So I often use the analogy that labor and birth is like throwing a stone into a calm pond and the ripples go, and nobody ever traces the ripples to the shore, but they do hit the shore and they do have an impact. And so in research in modern day childbirth, we're always looking at the throw of the stone and we're going, bip, bip, hit, it made a splash. We measure the splash and we all go away. Mm. We are sticking around to trace the ripples that go to the edge of the shore.
Thank God for people like you and your team, because that's, and that's the thing, you know, Rachel talks about this all the time. We've talked about this with other people, and it's really that. And I think in terms of midwifery versus this kind of medical model, we really don't put value in this sort of qualitative research and this experiential research. And yet that's the ripples. That's the ongoing effect. And, you know, for me, as you know, I'm a midwife, I'm a lactation consultant, but I really work in that postnatal sphere a lot. And all of those ripples, they can go on for years. And yet we talk about, and we hear this, the first 1,000 days is so important. But what has happened in that sort of labor, birth, is all impacting on how that person becomes a mother and goes through into this new life experience and cares for her baby and her toddler. And these years are formative. And for us to say it's not important to look at these parts of the research is, I think it's still a battle for us from this, from as midwifery and coming from this aspect. And I think it's something we have to keep fighting for, because we can't just say the RCTs are the important things and the numbers and blah, blah, blah. Like you say, the stone, the ripples are incredibly important and really important in terms of how we get that message into a story that helps us as clinicians and also helps us to teach women who are pregnant and their support people around them in what to expect, possibly in advocacy, in supporting them. Because I think if we've just got the numbers and the risks, this doesn't become the story. And for me, storytelling is how we learn, whether we are midwives, obstetricians, students, or we're about to be a new mum. So your research is incredibly important.
Sorry, Rachel, go on.
I was probably going to argue the same thing. I was going to say, I think you and me. A lot of the ripples are actually numbers and physiology and the outcome of what's the impact on the microbiome and the long-term health of a baby who's had antibiotics in labor. You know, nobody's looking at that. We're looking at the short-term, you know, the short-term outcomes. Yeah. Oral thrush maybe, and that's as far as we go. We don't go any further to, okay, what about 5 years down the track, 10 years down the track? So the ripples are
Ripples actually start before the birth, because they're the baggage that women bring to birth. They're the childhood sexual assault experiences. They're the domestic violence experiences. There's the anxiety, depression. There are the mothering and parenting issues. There is all these other things women bring to birth. And then we put them into these fragmented, stranger relationships where we just shoot arrows at their heart because we don't know them and we don't know what matters and we don't know how we need to be with them. And then we put them through that experience. They come out the other side shattered and we all go, you know, we've done a good job. Baby's alive. Mother's alive. So we do a lot of work in birth trauma, which I know is a particular interest of Rachel. And we're doing some papers at the moment looking at the birth trauma data and model of care, and you know, what is your risk of birth trauma under the different models of care. But women bring everything to that birth. They don't just go, "Kip, I'm going to shut the door and everything I was before 20 minutes ago is suddenly not relevant." And you know, we've got to handle with care, because we do enormous damage in the space of a 12-hour labor and birth that affects an entire life, and then affects the child, and then affects the next generation. So, you know, if we could just get the validation and the importance of that, having babies, into the psyche, we could change the history of humanity. I believe it's that important. I remember it was Saint, I think it was Saint Augustine who said, you know, he said, give me other mothers and I will give you other worlds. And I've always disagreed with him. And I think, give me other worlds and I'll give you other mothers. And then those mothers will give you other worlds. So why do we always put it on mothers mothers are on all the disasters that mothers make, we should be saying if we cherished and revered mothers, truly did, imagine the world we could shape. And maybe in that terrible kind of pathology of the patriarchy, they don't actually want that.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got some goosebumps going on right now.
And as we've said before, if men were the ones who had babies, things would be very, very different. You know, we'd have a very different maternity services.
Exactly. the mind boggles, doesn't it?
And now that we've got midwives in these positions of influence, as I say, the spheres of influence, that's what we need. We need midwives at every level in all different spheres, really bringing women's voices in where they've been previously not there and not heard.
Absolutely.
How do we get midwives interested in research? How do we move forward with that? How do we, the midwife who you have all encountered, you know, that there's lots of us around who's just say, this isn't the core and crux of my job. I mean, actually, I think just listening to this podcast has probably made hundreds and if not thousands of midwives now want to get into research, because listening to your passion is not addictive. What's the word?
Inspiring. Right. Is that the word?
Yeah. It could be addictive as well. I mean, brilliant. Bring it on. Make it addictive to be into research. I think you've probably talked about that. Maybe it's a silly question, but.
Well, I think we've got to make it sexy. Fuck, seriously.
Yeah.
We make research so jolly boring, the way we carry on, the way we publish in these journals where nobody can understand the frigging word you're saying, and they don't understand how to read an odds ratio or a relative risk, or, you know, they don't understand a forest plot and what does it mean when it crosses one, and all these things that we've almost celebrated our elevation above the rest of humanity by making our research impenetrable. And so one of my great passions is to make it penetrable, because what a lot of people don't realize is I'm actually not very smart. So I need to bring it down to my level to understand it, and that enables you to show it to others. So I do a lot of writing for The Conversation, a lot on social media. I do a lot of media interviews like this and podcasts and websites, and I edit baby website material because I know the importance of all of that. And to take really complex stuff and to put it down into simple language and to reach people and to hear and to listen to what they're saying and then use that to feedback how you're then going to get that into practice. It's very exciting. And I think there's many boring, boring academics who love to think they're better than everybody and then none of the stuff they do is of any use, and I can't be bothered with that, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It's again, it's storytelling, isn't it? Really?
Yes, it's storytelling. And I've worked it with journalists. What I've seen with journalists is that when I've gone and tried to hammer into their heads, you know, this is 3.5 times the risk, it doesn't work. But if I tell them a story of what this means to women, and I tell them about a birth, and I tell them about the impact, and I tell them a story, they're suddenly there with me.
Totally. Yeah, I love that. Thank you.
Just got to get sexy then.
Got to get sexy. Absolutely.
I want to sex you up tonight.
And excite people about research, you know, students, and bring them with you. And also, as an academic, don't be scared when they get better than you. Be excited that you've created the next generation. So academics also get threatened. They get threatened by the students because the students become more brilliant, and then they go, oh my goodness, well, I've got to up myself because they shouldn't be as smart as I am at this stage. But surely our job is not only to do great research, but to create great researchers to then change the world, to make the world a great place to live. And we've got to remember that it's three components, not one.
And to midwife the researchers, that's why I see supervision as, is midwifing the researchers.
Exactly.
I love that.
Oh, I was going to ask you what your favourite research was, but you got Have you got your favourite research?
Oh, look, the Wormpack trial, because it was the first big study I did, because I did it so much on my own for the first part, and it was, everyone told me I couldn't do it. And I remember an obstetrician who still lives in Australia, and I went to him with my project, and I was so excited because he just started, and everyone said, go share it with him because he's done research in this area. And I remember him saying, this is a load of rubbish. This will not be taken seriously. Warmth can't permeate the skin. So for people on the podcast, these are putting a warm compress on the perineum when a baby's being born to help reduce pain, and later on we found reduce trauma. And he said, this is rubbish. You'll be laughed out of the nation and you'll never get anywhere. And I'm really grateful for him because he triggered the stubbornness in me, which you can see is fairly endemic in me. And I went off and I thought, I'm bloody well going to prove to you that I am going to finish this trial. And when it entered the Cochrane Systematic Review as the thing that they can recommend for reducing perineal trauma, I did have a little jig. I told you so. And then this year, you know, I was really excited to be part of the Safety and Quality Commission's third and fourth degree standard. I had a little bit of a wobbly episode with a bundle of care in the previous 2 years that I was very unhappy with. And I was really able to get in there. And then to see it recommended for the nation up there as the level one evidence, that took 20 years. That took nearly 20 years from when I did the study to having it recommended widely. So, yeah, look, it's a long haul research. You don't get it all happening overnight. Yeah. So if you're impatient, then it's probably not the right job for you, but it's jolly exciting. And mix it up. You know, research on its own is boring. You've got to mix it up with high-degree research students and with teaching and with dabbling with the media and writing conversation articles and doing documentaries and, you know, mix it up, make life interesting.
And exhausting.
Oh, I still have plenty of time for my books and my music and all the other things I love. And my family, of course.
Hannah, I think that's a lovely place to end our conversation with you. What a lovely interview, just really thought-provoking and inspiring and so warm as well, just to hear your stories and how your path, the trajectory that you followed. And I just think it is something that will be really welcomed from our listeners. And I'm so grateful that you were here and you joined us. And I'm really also want to say I'm so grateful to you and the people that you work with for the research that you have done over the years, because it has changed so many of our practices for the better. It's helped so many women. And I feel quite emotional as well because and it's still doing that and it's still making change and it's powerful. So thank you.
And thank you for what you do, because if we don't get this out in a usable format and we don't keep hope up, and we mentioned that at the very beginning, didn't we? If we can't keep our hope up and our belief that we can do this and we are on the right track, then we'll never get there. So I guess my last message to midwives would be, we're on the precipice of massive change. Now, you still have to think about being on the precipice as a decadal strategy. But you know, the world has never been our oyster more than it is today. We've never been more educated. We've never had enough, so many people in positions of power. We've never had the world listening and advocating for midwives as they have in the last 5 years. Like, it's phenomenal. Midwives is on the tip of everybody's tongues. The thing that I get distressed about, and I think we've really got to do a lot of work on, is how crushed midwives are. Because here's everyone saying our name, and yet we don't actually value that ourselves, and we are exhausted and we are tired of fighting. So we've got to do one last hurrah, and we've got to get up off the ground, and we've got to take this home. And we will. We will. My students just inspire me every day. I talk to them, I spend time with them, and I know the world is right. And women inspire me more than anyone.
Yep.
That's why we do it.
It is indeed.
So thank you for all your amazing work. Keep it up. I love it. Love Rachel Reed. I've spent many a time in conversation with your wonderful brain, and it's lovely to meet you as well, Katie.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did. You can find out more about Hannah's work through the links in our show notes. You will also find Hannah on Instagram at HannahDarlin. Go and follow her for a boost of daily inspiration. I know, I say it every time, but please do pop a review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already, as this really does widen the important messages like we've shared here today. Recently, you have been posting some absolute crackers, and I will have to share them on Instagram, so thank you so much. And if you'd like to support the show further, have a look at our Patreon donation page. It's super easy and will just take a few ticks. Find the link in the show notes and over on our Instagram bio at The Midwife's Cauldron. For as little as one gluten-free chocolate brownie, we really like those, or as big splash spender as a whole Christmas fruitcake, it's completely your choice. You could help us bring more of this content to your already tantalized earbuds. Thank you, all of you, for supporting the show and showing your love. We are ever so grateful, and we look forward to seeing you with the next episode. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.